From NPR News, this is News in No Time, Tony Cox. We begin today with some important economic news. Last week, for the very first time, oil jumped past the $100 a barrel mark. Since then, prices have dropped, but only slightly. And now, there's more news of instability in the Middle East with a Turkish incursion into northern Iraq. With Middle Eastern tensions controlling what we pay at the pump, the chance that the cost of oil will continue to rise seems all but inevitable. But how will rising oil prices affect you, and what can we do about it? Meanwhile, the current economic strain is hitting some people pretty hard. Folks are tapping into those 401k nest eggs to pay bills and buy gas and groceries. But is that any way to manage your retirement fund? With me now to talk about oil prices and your 401k, we've got author and economist Julianne Malveau. She is president of Bennett College. Julianne, nice to talk to you as always.
Always a pleasure, Tony.
Let's begin with this. Folks were waiting for oil to hit that $100 a barrel mark. It came and it went. My question is going to be how you thought folks felt the strain, because I did notice, Julianne, that my gas went up again in the last couple of weeks. Is that why?
That's one of the reasons why. Of course, the oil that you paid for, the gas that you paid for, was from oil that did not cost $100 a barrel. The pipeline just doesn't move that quickly. But part of this market is about perceptions. And indeed, consumers have been feeling that. You're one of many. Some people have begun to withdraw, to spend less, to drive less. And so this affects our economy, and it does certainly reflect the concern about these high oil prices.
How likely is it that we're going to see oil at that price again? Just in the NPR National Report just before we came on, they indicated that gasoline had gone up 16 cents a gallon, and you indicated that was before the $100 spike. So what's going to happen?
We're going to see higher gasoline prices, I think, through the summer. You know, we get a spike because people tend to drive in the summer. It's a peak time for consumption. So we're going to see prices go up. It will affect our economy, Tony, in a number of ways. If people choose to drive less, it impacts our tourism market. Someone was going to go to a family reunion to Florida may choose to do something closer, and that's going to affect several markets. In addition, one of the things that I think is interesting is to see this summer the Olympics in Beijing, which really does signal the entry of China into the world market in a number of ways. That increased cost of living in China has an impact on gas prices in the United States. As more Chinese citizens choose to drive, it means there's more pressure and more competition for this resource, which is a scarce resource. It's a resource that the United States has not paid attention to since we first had a nibble at an energy crisis in 1973. And so we should fasten our seatbelts and basically say, why have we spent 35 years not dealing with issues of conservation?
One last thing on gas prices before we go on to topic number two. And I didn't know this. I don't know whether you did or not. But apparently there is such a thing as winter gasoline and summer gasoline. And they have different mixtures, and they also have different prices.
You know, Tony, I just learned that as well. And it raises all kinds of questions about the mix that we have and how environmentally friendly it is. But the fact is that we know we see these spikes in demand that are a function of seasonality. And so while winter gasoline may be different from summer gasoline, it's all pricey.
Absolutely. In fact, that leads us into our next topic, Julianne, with the prices of homes falling and banks becoming more stingy about what they loan out, and the price of gas, as we've just mentioned. Some folks are turning to another source of funds, their own retirement accounts. Is this ever a good idea?
It's never a good idea, but let's look at what's going on. For a very long time, American consumers had been using home equity as a way of stretching their consumption dollar. Indeed, debt was the economic driver in the early part of the 21st century, people borrowing against their homes, people using credit cards, but it was mostly home borrowing. People's houses had appreciated so much they could pull money out, and they could use that for college tuitions, for a new car, for any number of things. Now they don't have that pot to pull on anymore. So where's their money? It's in their 401k. But this is a really bad deal because you're taking money out of your future to pay for your present. how are you going to replace that? We know that Social Security will provide some, but not all, of your retirement income. Those folks who are pulling into their 401ks are gambling their future against their present.
But it's you're caught between a rock and a hard place, are you not? Because if you don't pull that money out from some place, and if the 401k is the only place where you have any money set aside, what choices do you have?
Well, Tony, it depends on what you're pulling it out for. If you're pulling it out to pay your mortgage because you think, you know, you've come on hard times, you need 3 months' worth of money to save your home, that's one thing. If you're pulling it out for kibbles and bits, which is goodies and stuff, which many of us can convince ourselves that we need, that's another issue. And even when you're pulling it out for the home loan, I encourage people to sit down and make sure they have a 12- and 24-month plan. How long do you need to tap into this 401k? Is it a one-time thing? Is it a permanent thing? If you're tapping in there to provide your child's tuition, make your child take out a loan.
You know, I don't know how many people, Julianne, know that when you take out that money before you are 59 and a half years old, that you pay a penalty and a higher tax rate for that money. Is that correct?
That's exactly it, and that's another piece of it. I don't care what the exigency is. You can say that you're about to go bankrupt and you need the money, but you will have to pay a penalty if you're younger than 59 and a half, and that money is now perceived as income. So whatever your income level is and whatever tax rate you're paying on your income, that's now income to you because you sheltered it tax-free, so when you take it out, it's income.
Speaking of retirement accounts, just last week the Supreme Court ruled that workers have a right to sue their employers if they think that their retirement accounts are being mismanaged. This is a very interesting situation, Julianne. What impact do you think this is going to have on folks who hold retirement accounts, first of all?
I think it raises awareness for consumers. Too many people have trusted that their employers would do the right thing. But can I spell Enron for you to talk about the ways that employers with 401ks did not do the right thing? All of those Enron people lost their retirement. And so workers righteously assume that the employers are going to do the best for them. And when they don't, they are, you know, they're out of luck. Taking this to the Supreme Court ought to raise a question for everyone who has a 401k about how it's managed. Because oftentimes you have some input in the management. You may have some input in the portfolio you have. You may be able to decide that you want to be aggressive or to be very conservative, and your administrator has to cooperate with you. When they don't, obviously, this is why we have cases going to court. But here's what we've transitioned, Tony, from a platform where workers could trust their employers and trust the government to take care of them in retirement to a platform where we all have to aggressively be informed about where our dollars are going and what we want our retirement to look like.
Here's a question. How do you distinguish, if you hold a 401k, let's say, and you are not happy necessarily with how your employer is investing your retirement fund, how do you distinguish between mismanagement of the fund that would make the company liable under this new ruling, as opposed to the company simply making the wrong choices, maybe picking a bad investment or a losing investment? But does it necessarily rise to mismanagement if you lose money?
Not necessarily, but you want to look at who the winners are. You want to look at whether the company invested exclusively in its own stock, which is self-serving in many cases. Again, let's spell Enron. We want to look at any number of other things in terms of who was on the investment board, what kind of advice they got. It's certainly possible, especially in a volatile market, to lose money. And we've seen a very volatile market in the last 3 months. So, you know, it's very possible to see a losing portfolio. What did people do about it? And who are the winners in a losing portfolio?
Is a 401k, given all of the vagaries that we've had in the economic sector of this country, is it still a good place to go to?
It's an important place to go to. It's a place where often there's an employee match so that if an employee and employer are matching, you're putting in 7%, your employer is putting in 7%, you're making more money than you've invested. You just have to be vigilant and careful about the terms and conditions of your investment. We certainly certainly could change public policy to make sure that people got an investment match in other ways. But right now, the way that you are able to leverage is through a 401k. Every worker doesn't have it, but those who do should take advantage of it. But they should be clear, and they should be clear with their human resource person how this money is being invested and what rights they have in changing the course and the path of that investment. Most of these accounts come up once a year where you can change the asset allocation. And a lot of people get the notice, you want to change it, and they just ignore it. We've got to be more aggressive about investing in our futures.
We have about a minute left. What do you do, Julianne Malveau, if you're just not savvy financially? You get the statement. You just want to know if the money is going up or going down. You don't really care how it gets there. What do you do to keep yourself informed?
You read. You aggressively get yourself organized around these things. If necessary, you get a counselor or some advisor. Many of the banks and many of the insurance companies do provide people. Of course, there's a footnote there. Oftentimes, they're pushing their products. MotleyFool.com, there are a number of websites that walk you through what you need to do. I tell people, you've got to spend, a day a month looking at your own money. You've got to spend a full day looking at what's going where, raising questions, and then going about getting answers. If you don't feel comfortable doing it by yourself, get it with a team. Lots of people have investment clubs or personal finance clubs or financial literacy clubs. Any number of the banks have these financial literacy websites. Wachovia does, HSBC, Call the Roll, and they will walk you through what you need to do.
That's where we got to stop, Julianne. Our time is out. I appreciate it. Julianne Malveau, author and economist. She's also president of Bennett College.
Thank you, Tony.
This is News in Notes. I'm Tony Cox. On our bloggers' roundtable today, the Democrats played nice in Texas last week, but what a difference a weekend makes. Charges and countercharges are flying between Clinton and Obama, and the latest involves a photograph. And it's official. There's now another candidate in the race for president, and he's no newcomer. Plus, the Oscars may be over, but Hollywood has another biopic in the works starring Beyoncé as none other than blues diva Etta James. Is that a good fit? We'll find out. Joining me on today's roundtable is Amber Nicole. She blogs at Nicola.com. Also, Patrice Elizabeth Grail Yersic, creator of Afrobella.com, and Robert Redding. He publishes the RedingNewsReview.com. Hello, everybody. How are you?
Hello.
Hi.
Let's start with this. Last Thursday, of course, Senators Clinton and Obama faced off in Austin for a presidential debate, and Hillary and Barack both kept their cool as they went back and forth over immigration, health care, and Clinton's allegations that Obama has plagiarized in his speeches. Now, at the end, well, to give you an idea of the tone and how cordial it was, we have two clips. We're going to play them back to back. The first one is Clinton, and then we'll hear Obama, and then we'll come back and talk about it. Here's Hillary Clinton.
There are comparisons and contrasts to be drawn between us, and it's important that voters get that information. So, yes, I do think that words are important and words matter, but actions speak louder than words.
If we can't inspire the American people to go beyond the racial divisions and the religious divisions and the regional divisions that have plagued our politics for so long, then we will continue to see the kind of gridlock in Washington that is resulting in families suffering in very real ways. I'm running for president to start doing something about that suffering, and so are the people who are behind my campaign.
So, Patrice, that was Thursday. Now, after those civilized debates, the Clinton campaign is stepping up its criticism of Obama. The Obama campaign is angry about the release of this photograph. What happened from Thursday to Monday?
I mean, I think the people who are behind the campaigns are giving them some tips on how to be more tactical. I agree with Barack Obama that Hillary's anger, the shame on you, Barack Obama, and the finger shaking seemed extremely tactical to me, especially in light of those two clips that you just played from the debate. And in these last stages, we're going to see a lot more of the ugly side of that kind of politics, the splitting hairs over policies, even though as similar as they may be, they're going to try to prove why what they're saying is the right thing.
There's another debate, Robert, coming up in Ohio. What tone would you expect in that debate?
a vicious one, because this picture that they've been circulating, the Clinton administration, I would say, you know, and I just do think they are an administration. They are trying to get back into power here. You know, Clinton's still in office. Hillary is. So they're trying to, of course, seize the White House, and they'll do anything to do that. And this is the reason why I'm not a Democrat anymore. That's the reason why I'm an independent. Because you have racists in both parties. You have racists in the Republicans and racists in the Democrats, and I think that this is an issue where they're using a picture to quote-unquote, to say 1,000 words, and it says nothing about Barack Obama and where he stands.
Let's talk about that photograph, Amber, with you, because for people who are not aware, this is just circulating today, and it is a photograph taken in 2006 in Barack's home in Kenya, and it shows Barack in Somali elder garb, and I'm looking at a photograph of it right now, and I'm trying to describe it. I guess the thing that stands out most about it is that he has a white turban around his head, which sends all sorts of signals. What is your take, Amber, on this photograph?
Well, you know, I think the thing that's really interesting about this particular picture and in general about this election is the amount of distance that Obama has attempted to keep between himself and his Islamic heritage. And I think given, you know, the state of our country right now, I feel like one of the, you know, I think what this image evokes in people, and as far as the emotion is concerned, is I think it brings sort of to light that attachment that he does have, you know, a heritage that he has tried to pretty much avoid during this election.
You know, one of the things that we should point out to our listeners, to see the image that we are talking about, you can go to our blog, nprnewsandviews.org, to see it for yourself. Now, the Clinton campaign and their new manager, Maggie Williams, issued a statement in response to the criticism from the Obama camp about the photograph, and without reading the entire statement, it basically says, enough, that's a quote actually, and it talks about the fact that this is, that if Barack Obama's campaign wants to suggest that a photo of him wearing a traditional Somali clothing is divisive, they should be ashamed. There's that word ashamed again. Mm-hmm. Hillary Clinton has worn the traditional clothing of countries she has visited and had those photos published widely. So the question, back to you, Robert, is this fair game, though?
Well, again, they're trying to say that a picture says 1,000 words, and I agree with you. He is a little fuzzy on race. He's a little not very, I guess, on point in terms of race when he talks, and when he talks about being a presidential candidate, and when he talks about what he wants to do in America. I agree with her on that, but at the same time, this picture is being promoted as if he's a Muslim, and that is a little bit misleading. In addition to that, one of the reports on this, which this all emanates from the Drudge Report, Matt Drudge, one of our chief competitors, he says in his article, editor's note here, and this is interesting wording, other leaders have worn local costumes. It is not correct to call this a costume. This is a traditional African garb that these folks in this part of the world wear, and it is not correct to characterize it as a costume. I think that has to be pointed out as well.
Patrice, last question on this topic before we move on. The impact that this photograph will have, particularly coming up to Texas and Ohio, how would you characterize it? Will it be something that will count or will it not?
I mean, it depends on, of course, which side of the fence you stand on. I think the people who support Barack Obama, I think, are willing to overlook this kind of thing as a vicious attack. And he needs to be particularly careful with how he fields this attack. I think that there are a fair number of people who do believe the inaccurate reports that he has, you know, this very strong Islamic background. And you know, it's politics as usual. It's very interesting that they're releasing this photo at this time. And especially in a state like Texas, it'll be real interesting to see how it goes down.
Another thing that happened over the weekend that could have an impact on the race, although what impact it could have is still to be determined, is the entry into the race of none other than Ralph Nader, the Green Party candidate, third party candidate now, who has thrown his hat officially into the presidential race. Amber, what do you think of Nader getting in?
I think it's hysterical. I always love it when Nader gets in the race. It kind of makes things a little bit more interesting. But I mean, I think the biggest implications that, you know, that we're looking at here is for the Democratic Party, because generally that's where he tends to shake things up a bit. So I'm kind of interested to see, you know, where the Clinton and the Obama people fall on the Nader issue.
You know, he was considered to be a spoiler in the race in 2000. Do you think, Robert, that he can play that role again this time around?
Yes, I think he can play this bowler. And, you know, Brock is in a catch-22 here because he was asked, what do you think about Nader getting in earlier this weekend? And basically the camp said that, you know what, we're not concerned about him because, of course, duh, they have a race in front of them. They have to win first before they even get to that race. In short, I would say about Ralph Nader is most of the 50% of the people that are in the Green Party are black. And this is a very big blow to Cynthia McKinney, who would have locked up this nomination. If he intends to run as a Green Party person, more likely than not, he's going to win this nomination now. And I'm sure that infuriates a lot of people.
Patrice, what do you say?
I mean, I agree with Amber. It's very, I love when Ralph Nader gets involved. I really don't feel like he has the strength behind him that he had, you know, during the Bush Gore days, where he could be a strong and viable spoiler. I think people kind of are so afraid of that right now. But the topics that he brings to the table and the kind of debate that he brings to politics, I think it's important, and I'm very, very interested to see how Clinton and Obama address him when the opportunity comes.
One of his arguments, Amber, was that he speaks for the independents who are not being spoken to, in his view, either by the two Democratic challengers or by the Republican candidate, and that he feels that legitimizes, he being Nader, his attempt to get into the race to have those issues brought to the fore. Is legitimate or not legitimate?
Probably, in my opinion, I would say not legitimate. I mean, I'm an independent, and I don't feel like Nader speaks for me. Nonetheless, I think he does speak for a large, you know, a certain percentage of Americans who are disgruntled in a lot of ways and don't, you know, aren't happy with either party. So, I don't know. I mean, for me, I don't think he speaks for me, but I do think he's a valid, you know, player in this race.
Let's move on to one other thing. Barack's wife, Michelle Obama, made headlines with a statement about patriotism recently, and it's been back and forth and back and forth. And just recently to that, we had Bill O'Reilly talking about her. Now, Bill O'Reilly of Fox News is not someone that is traditionally identified with supporting black causes necessarily, but in this case, he came to the defense, or it could be construed that he came to the defense of Michelle Obama, who made the comment about feeling really proud to be an American for the first time as an adult. Here's what Bill O'Reilly had to say.
I don't want to go on a lynching party against Michelle Obama unless there's evidence, hard facts, that say this is how the woman really feels. If that's how she really feels, that America's a bad country or a flawed nation, whatever, then that's legit.
Now, there have been some who have taken issue with the word lynching. Do either of you take any issue with Bill O'Reilly's use of that term in this context?
I don't. I don't think he meant it in the conventional sense. I think that it is a slip of the tongue, because what's interesting about right before that part where he said what he said was people have been seizing on all of these crazy things that people have been saying and kind of taking them out of context, and I don't think that's fair to them. And then he's turned around and he's taken out of context on his Lynch remark. So I'm not one that typically defends Bill O'Reilly. I don't think he meant it in a conventional sense.
Amber, what do you think? Is this word lynching becoming, are we overly sensitive to that word?
I don't think we're overly sensitive. I think it's a pretty racially charged word, and I think people who use it are either A, you know, not being wise, or they're very calculated. In O'Reilly's case, I think he's very calculated. In some sense of the word, he's a shock jock. So he knows what he's doing, and I believe he was very calculated in using that particular word.
Do you share that view, Patrice?
I completely agree. You know, even if you do want to give him the benefit of the doubt that he was defending Michelle Obama, you would think you would have learned from the recent Golf Channel incident with Tiger Woods. And, you know, I mean, I can't imagine somebody who paints themselves as being on the pulse of the news cycle is completely unaware of the weight of that particular word. I think at best he was courting controversy, and at worst he was revealing an aspect of his character that might be sadly unsurprising.
Well,
I don't know.
He certainly said that he wanted to get to the bottom of it, and I suppose the proof would be in the pudding if, in fact, they do get to the bottom of that. It all began with a woman who called in and said that she knew what was in Michelle Obama's heart and called her a militant, et cetera, et cetera. And that prompted O'Reilly to respond in the fashion that he did. All right, we'll wait and see what happens with that. We're going to move on to Hollywood, because although the Oscars are over, Hollywood is now involved with a new film, a biopic about none other than Etta James. And this is a person, in case there's anyone out there who was not familiar with the great Etta James, this is her.
At last, my love has come along.
Okay, Patrice, Beyonce is going to play Etta James, and Beyonce is certainly good. No one would argue with that. Etta James is a classic, and a very different kind of classic than Beyonce. Can she pull this off?
I mean, Beyonce's talent is undeniable. She's a great singer. She's a great dancer. It's the acting that I'm really worried about. And Etta James's story is so big and so powerful. And I really wish we'd get back to letting actors do the acting. There are a lot of incredibly talented black actresses that can't find this kind of work right now.
Well, you know, Robert, the issue here, one of the issues is class and style. And Etta James herself has said that, you know, she called Beyonce bougie, and I don't think she meant it in a derogatory way, but she was saying it in contrast to herself, that she was a hard-driving, you know, former heroin addict and not a bougie person at all. In fact, Etta said she was the kind of woman who went in the bathroom to smoke. So how would you distinguish the two, and do you think that Beyonce's acting would be good enough to help her overcome that cultural divide?
No, and I don't think that she will do a good job in this role. I think that there are better people. I think that let actors do the acting. Just because she looks the part doesn't mean she'll actually be good in the part. As far as her versatility in the kind of mindset of Miss James and thinking about her own career, I think that, you know, when you make so much, I'm starting to lose respect for Beyonce because she spent so much time shaking her rear end to make money. Mm-hmm. And I don't think she has to do that. So you know, we're talking about night and day in terms of these two different people.
You're probably one of the few people who I've ever heard say that, Robert, to be quite
She's
honest
with you.
She's
a beautiful woman. I don't think she has to continue.
You think
to,
she has to do that? Okay. Yeah. Amber, what do you say about her playing this? I mean, this is a hardcore role for her.
Yeah, I mean, I was talking with my husband about this morning, and the first thing I said was, I don't think she's grimy enough, for lack of a better word. But I agree with what the previous people said. I think that there are tremendous black actresses right now who could kill that role. And I don't think Beyonce is a black actress. I think she's an entertainer and a singer, among other things. But she's not an actress, and she hasn't shown that to us in really any way, in my personal opinion. And I agree. I think that it's unfortunate, and I hope that she can do well in the role and do it justice, but I just don't have the faith that she will.
I'm not comparing her talents as an actor to those of Denzel Washington, but you remember when Denzel played the character, the villain in Training Day, people were upset because they didn't like the fact that he had gone to the other end, so to speak, but he felt that it was a good thing for him as an actor. Maybe this will be a good thing for Beyonce as an actor. What do you say, Amber?
We'll see. I mean, I guess we'll see, but I just, I don't know. I have to say that I can't speak for the other actors in Hollywood right now, but I grew up, and my mom's an actress, and I mean, there's a professional craft there that I feel like a lot of times is being passed over, and I don't know that I would put Beyonce on the level of Denzel Washington. I think he went into character for that, and I don't know what she'll be doing when she takes on this role.
Robert, you got 10 seconds to respond. I cut
Real
you
quickly,
off.
Again, we're talking about him. Denzel Washington going from being a good guy to being a bad guy, and that was stretching him as an actor. But she's got to be an actress first.
Oh. Right.
Tough words, absolutely. Amber Nicole of Nicola.com. She's on the line from KUOW in Seattle. Patrice Elizabeth Grail Yersic, the creator of Afrobella.com. She joined from member station WLRN in Miami. And Robert Redding publishes the RedingNewsReview.com. He's with me from Radio People Studios in Monroe, Louisiana. Everybody, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Tony Cox, and this is News and Notes. Now to a story of violence, hope, and redemption. James McBride's new novel, Song Yet Sung, is a semi-fictional account of slavery set in pre-Civil War Maryland. The story centers around a runaway slave and a determined slave catcher. But the book does more than tackle issues of race. McBride raises larger questions about the legacy of slavery and what it means to be human. NPR's Farai Today recently caught up with McBride, who described two of the main characters, both of them strong women with very different lives.
Well, Liz Spokot is a very beautiful 19-year-old black woman who dreams of the future. And the future that she dreams of the African-American race is very bleak. She dreams of young men driving around in motor carriages with music booming throughout, singing songs of murder and so forth, and fat black children who run from books like they're poison. And so she becomes known as the dreamer, and these dreams that she has are both troubling and enlightening for her because she dreams of a song yet sung that is supposed to lead her and others to freedom. The other main character is Patty Cannon, who is based on a real character named Patty Cannon, who was a slave stealer in the southern Delaware, Maryland, Eastern Shore area. And Patty Cannon is a very beautiful, handsome woman who has a gang of white and black slave stealers who steal slaves and sells them south. And Patty Cannon is trying to catch Liz Spokot because Liz escaped from Patty the first time.
In fact, you have a complicated situation where, as part of her enterprise, she will have, as you mentioned, black henchmen who are with her at all times. What was it like to get into this space where you could portray not just slave and free, but also these nuances of allegiances?
Well, I'm a little embarrassed to confess that it wasn't that hard to get into Cannon's head or into the head of her henchmen, because people were starving, people were hungry, and people will do a lot for money, irrespective of how it affects others.
Now, you have scenes of violence, combat, brutality. At one point near the end of the book, you say simply, it was all hands and teeth now. You say it wasn't that hard to get into the mindset of, you know, the struggles that people throughout humanity have had. What was it like to write combat scenes?
It was not easy. The combat scenes that you speak of involve a character named the Woolman, who was a black slave who lives out in the woods and who even black people are afraid of. And he lives free, and he ends up fighting Patty Cannon and others to try to free his son who's been captured. And those scenes were difficult to do, partly because the Woolman, although he is a kind of a wild person, he's basically a shy man who is afraid of people. And I've never written about violence in a way that, you know, that is superfluous or meaningless. These battle scenes, these fight scenes had to take place in order for the characters to free themselves of the inner and outer demons that plagued them.
Why do you have so many strong and differentiated female characters? I mean, in your memoir, you also are telling a woman's story. Why do you seem to gravitate towards female characters?
Listen, I was raised by a strong woman. And also, women have the kind of emotional makeup that men don't have, in that, without generalizing, but at least in my life, I've seen women take the kind of emotional hits that would shatter men into a million pieces. Women simply get up off the canvas and they come back at you again and again. Not necessarily with fists, but with a will and a determination and a sense of desire and boldness and courage that sometimes men just can't drum up. I mean, men, it's, you know, it's a kind of a testosterone element, you know. Bleh, you know. But women, they just seem to be stronger. They have a lot more emotional business that you can manipulate as a writer. And they're deeper. And also, they're not spoken for in this context of historical novels. Historically, women have a lot, have done so much more and are a lot more interesting to deal with, rather than the, you know, the Jesse Jameses and the John Waynes and so forth that we've become used to mythologizing.
What about the code? You have this running theme of signs and symbols that enslaved people can show to each other in different ways, clothing and items that are hung from trees and all sorts of, you know, lines drawn in the dirt. How much of that comes from research, and how much of that is something that you invented to hold this story together?
I don't know. A lot of it is real. When I went to Oberlin Conservatory, and one of the first classes I took was an African-American music history course. And anyone who's taken an African-American music history course, from anyone who knows what they're doing, will see that a lot of what was handed down historically in terms of black history musically has to do with the messages that people gave each other through the music. So in terms of the codes, I think the music is quite evident that the codes existed, at least in terms of the music. In terms of the other things, quilt signs that were made on quilts, blacksmithing, blacksmith hammering at certain tempos and times and so forth, I think some of that existed. How much of it, I don't know. You know, Frederick Douglass, Harriet Tubman, they never told, they never revealed how they got free. In fact, Frederick Douglass, he criticized those like Henry Box Brown and so forth, the guy who shipped himself north in a box. He criticized those people for telling folks how they got free because he knew there were millions of others who were trying still to get free. I don't think there was the codes were like a book, like, you know, an army manual of this was the code. But I think in certain regions, in certain areas, there's no question that there were codes, unwritten codes that were used by those who worked the trade. I think the codes were used. How much? I don't know. I mean, some of the business I cooked up on my own, but most of it I found from other places.
You have a physical space where you write and you also perform, practice your music. What is it about being a musician that also stimulates you, and what different flavor does it bring to your life than writing?
Well, I have a little spot in Manhattan, Manhattan's Hell's Kitchen, that I've been going to for years that I share with a guy who fixes saxophones. And I go in and chat. When the musicians are different, they like to talk. They're a little bit like journalists. They're like cheap intellectuals. They know a little bit
about
everything.
That's right. That's right. I'll take my tinfoil hat and put it on.
So, I mean, the camaraderie of music and being with musicians and the collaborative process that is involved in the music process is something that helps me as a writer and as a screenwriter. Because even to write a book like Song Yek Sung, you have to interview dozens of people. You have to involve people in the collaborative process so you won't get the material that you need that will make your story go. And so music gives you that. It helps you understand that you're part of a bigger song. You're just a member of the band.
Someone once told me that creative people are cursed because there's never an end. If you're a creative person, there's always a next, another idea. What's the worst part to you about doing what you do?
Probably having to get up at 3 o'clock in the morning because you heard someone say something and you need to write it down, or you get an idea, you need to write it down. Also, the notion that this is easy work. And also you become a target. You go from being a nobody to being somebody that people think, you know, they think you're rich, they want to borrow money. They don't really understand that, you know, that you're still competing, that you're still trying to be, you know, a viable artist, and you're still trying to say something that's important. And you're trying not to tell the same joke twice artistically. So you have to kind of shut yourself off from the world a little bit. And that hurts you artistically a little bit.
Well, on that note, James McBride, thank you so much.
Well, thank you for having me.
Writer and musician James McBride speaking with NPR's Farai Tadea. His latest book is Song Yet Sung. You can hear James read from his new novel at our website, nprnewsandnotes.org. What does it feel like when your child just stops talking? How does it impact you, your work, your life, and your child's life as well? Leslie Saar has found answers to some of those questions. She is an acclaimed artist who transformed her family's struggles with autism into something positive. She has used the experience as the basis for new and innovative approaches to her art. Here's Leslie's conversation with Farai.
Your daughter, Geneva, was born in 1991. When did you notice that she had a different way of approaching the world than other kids her age?
Well, I guess the first thing that I suppose should have been a clue, but in the 90s it wasn't that prevalent, was you could make a lot of racket, like behind her, and she wouldn't turn around. She would be so engrossed in what she was doing, you know. But her language seemed normal. She was starting to say words at 6 months and 9 months and putting like 3-word sentences together at 1 year. But when she was 18 months old, she stopped learning new words and then a few months later stopped using the words she knew. So by the age of 2, she just wasn't speaking at all. Her language disappeared. So when I talked to our family doctor, that was just like flags going up everywhere. It's not normal to have language and lose it. So since she was very shortly after that diagnosed with autism at the age of 2.
So when the doctors told you that your daughter had autism, fill in the blanks for me. Tell me what they told you to expect.
Well, that was, I think, the most difficult part. And I have to say, I probably cried every day for like 2 years. Not the way I felt about my child, but every time I had to take her for MRIs and these tests and diagnoses, just the kind of negativity and kind of fear that was inspired from what the experts said to me.
Did it impact you as an artist?
Well, it did pretty much early on because I started questioning notions of normalcy, like what was and wasn't normal, and you know what society thinks is normal, and those like value judgments that are placed on it. And I did a series called Anomalies, where I did portraits of existing people that were outside of the realm of normalcy, either physically or mentally, neurologically, as in the case of my autistic daughter.
Did you think about or experiment with how language affected your artwork?
Well, yes, my most recent series, which are these pen and ink drawings with photographs that I've taken, I just thought, well, I would like to not do figurative stuff and not anything political or kind of social commentary, but just something that's more free and using graphics and pen and ink kind of as a language to just sort of explore another world. So I was very influenced by her in my most recent series.
She actually stopped talking a second time. How old was she and how did that happen?
Yeah, that was strange. She was maybe 13, just like maybe the second semester of middle school. And she was into her perseveration, which is a common thing autistic kids do. They'll repeat the same thing over and over and over again. Or she was talking to her imaginary friends nonstop. And my husband, I'm sure he regrets it, but he took a timer and he set it to 5 minutes. And he said, could you just stop talking for 5 minutes? And she stopped talking for a year and a half. And I don't know if that was why or if that implanted the idea or if it was just a control thing, because she's really into control, but she did not say one word. Even by herself, you'd like kind of spy on her. She'd make noises, but not one word. Just the incredible discipline of that. And
that must have been heartbreaking.
Was just like, is this going to happen? Is this going to be like this forever? She's just going to never start talking again? Because she didn't really start talking again until she was 7 years old.
So between 7 and 13, she was talking, mm-hmm. and then?
Yeah, for a year and a half. So she would just sit in class, just like write things out, her answers. And she did well scholastically. She would sign and write things out. And, you know, that's how she communicated, just nonverbal totally, just by choice. And you would ask her, why have you stopped talking? And she'd say something like, I am the silent monk or some cryptic, you know, thing. It was just very mysterious. And then one morning I came, she was sitting at the table for breakfast, and she said, hi, dear. Tears came streaming down just for this nonsensical reason. As she stopped talking, she all of a sudden started talking again. So that was kind of an epiphany that let me realize that these things are stages that she's going through, and, you know, just to kind of have faith and hope that it will change.
You brought in some pictures of your daughter, and she's a very beautiful, striking young lady. She's 16 now. Oh. What's her life like?
She's enrolled in public school, and she's in a special day program, which is diploma-bound. And she takes a few mainstream classes like computer animation. And, you know, she goes to school, and sometimes she plans things she wants to do afterwards. And she comes home, she's on her computer. She has all of these imaginary friends and children, and she deals with her, like, imaginary world. And she's very self-sufficient. She fixes all of her own meals. She won't let me cook for her, so she makes her dinners. And you know, very schedule is very important to her, you know, that kind of routine. Every Saturday I have to take her to the same Chinese restaurant for lunch. And those kinds of things, by letting her have those things, I mean, it's not terribly exciting for me to go to the same Chinese restaurant every Saturday, but that lets her cope with, I think, the chaos that the world must seem to her because of her perception and the fact that she's different and it's so difficult for her socially to deal, that I kind of let her have those things. I give her those things. So that she definitely has routines like that.
In radio, you have this concept of riding the levels. So, you know, if someone's voice gets really loud, you turn things down a bit, and if, you know, vice versa. And it sounds to me like autism, in some ways, you can't ride the levels. Everything is just coming at you at once.
Mm-hmm. Right. Like I've heard it described by people who are autistic and articulate that, you know, you could be in a restaurant and the person you're talking to, their voice is just as loud or as important as the dishes clanging and the people talking in the corner or a siren going by. And a lot of times it sounds like just static, like you're in between two radio stations. And I remember when she was quite young, it was hard to take her out in the sun. The light was too much, or just certain places are just too noisy for her. So a lot of it, a lot of the odd behavior is a reaction to the perception.
Has being part of a family of artists helped you in any way envision a life for her that has hope?
Yes, definitely. I think that's a good question. Another thing she got into doing was, I thought this was a Halloween costume. It was like army fatigues and an army green army jacket and like a little cap. She looked like Che, you know, like a Cuban revolutionist. So, and I was kind of accepting, but I was so afraid of what everyone, oh, what kind of mother would let her daughter dress like Che for 6 months? You start worrying about what other people are thinking about you. And luckily, my husband is the same. He's from Iceland and a little bit kind of odd and different himself. So at least both of us are from that thinking that we don't need to ramrod her into being normal to appreciate. And it's kind of amusing and funny, the odd things she does to us.
But there are a lot of families who don't have the resources that you have, including probably emotionally. What kind of advice would you give them for dealing with their child?
I try to read something that they are initiating to use that as to educate them. For instance, my daughter liked computers. So we kind of like broke down and got her this computer thinking she might destroy it in one day and there goes a ton of money, you know. But you kind of have to take some risks sometimes and kind of give them a chance, because that's they're going to show you the way that they're best capable of learning.
Leslie, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
For Ajadeya, talking with Leslie Saar. Leslie is a visual artist who lives in Los Angeles. Works inspired by her daughter Geneva can be seen at the Walter Maceo Gallery in Santa Monica, California.